This episode is presented by The Brooklyn Kitchen. Learn more at brooklynkitchen.com.
Borders seem to be all over the news lately. You've got trade wars, Brexit, and of course, Trump's wall. This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring how borders are created and blurred in the world of food.
We try to focus a lot on the fact that they are chefs by nature, that the refugee thing is just a status for them.
And after the Soviet space ended, I don't think there was much research. It was all considered just Soviet food or Russian food, and I don't think it gives a lot of those cultures credit.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview an extraordinary person on their road to success. And today, my guest is someone who is experiencing her year of yes. This is after having grown up in New Orleans as the daughter of Vietnamese immigrants and very recently competing on Top Chef. Nini Nguyen, so happy to see you here.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So you grew up in New Orleans, but your life was really set off course by Hurricane Katrina, along with many, many other people. I wonder if you could take me back to that moment of Hurricane Katrina, and what was it like having that hurricane boring down on your life, your choices, and your family?
So growing up in New Orleans, every year you pretty much evacuate at least once. And for our family, we always went to Houston because there's a lot of food, Vietnamese people, and we would just go shopping. But this time, we knew something was different, and we went, but we didn't shop very much because we were like, we didn't know what would happen.
What kind of shop are we talking about? Like, you know, Gucci handbags?
Or? we would go to the Galleria Mall and like shop for clothes, shop for food. Because there's always like so many different exotic things you could buy in Houston. We weren't shopping that much. And my mom, I could tell she was like really worried. I was 18, 19 at the time. And we learned that we couldn't get back in. We were in Texas for about a week and we had to figure out like, well, if we can't go home, where are we going to stay? Because we can't stay in these hotels. Like everything was so booked. We were lucky to get a room. And so we went to Baton Rouge, where my brother has my dad has a sister, my aunt. And so we stayed with them for a little bit until we could get in. But the damage in New Orleans East was very minimum. There was about 2 inches of water in our home. But because they didn't let us back in for a month, until a month later, the mold and everything had grown. So
how terrible.
Yeah.
And you feel like if you had gotten back earlier, actually, you could have moved in, cleaned up.
Yeah.
So what happened to your house?
So it had to get gutted. My parents ended up selling. And then my parents, at that point, they were tired of evacuating every year. So they decided to move to Baton Rouge.
And so you joined them, but you left school because you were going to school then. And I feel like that's the piece that really set you off course, right?
Yeah. So I went to UNO for my first year. And then my second year.
So I imagine that's University of New Orleans.
Yes, yes, yes. And for my second year, it was the first week of school that Katrina happened. And so then all of the displaced students could go to any other university. And when I was in Baton Rouge, I went to LSU, Louisiana State University. And I needed to figure out, like, I need a job. I can't just not work. My parents are trying to find a place to live. We can't live with my aunt forever. And so then
did it wipe out savings? In losing the house or selling the house? Because you ended up working to help pay for your lifestyle and your parents' lifestyle.
My dad was working, but then when Katrina happened, he didn't have a job. So then he's trying to, everyone's trying to find work. My mom at least had her, she is a manicurist, and so then she still had all of her clients. And so we're all just trying to figure out how to just make it happen. And I started, I was a host at a sushi restaurant. That was my very first restaurant job. And I went to school. And so then we were just doing day by day, trying to figure it out. And I grew to love the restaurant industry.
So what about, was it something about hostessing or the camaraderie?
The camaraderie, the culture. I think also like the sense of humor people had in the restaurant world.
Tell me about that. Like, where's the sense of humor?
I guess the people that I worked with, it was funny. Like, we would have regulars and it would be like, oh, that person wants this thing again. And it was just, I just loved it. The vibe. And it didn't dawn to me like that I wanted to be a chef then. It took a couple of years.
And so when did that first idea dawn on you?
I actually went to a pastry shop in New Orleans. We visited because we were only an hour away and we still had family in New Orleans. And so I visited a pastry shop called Sucre and I was like, this is what I want to do. Like, I was in business marketing and I loved it, but I didn't see anything viable to happen. And I graduated in 2009, so it was after 2008. No one I knew could get a job that was better than me serving tables. and so I was like, well, if I can't really make money with the degree that I have right now, then I'm going to do what I love. And I've always enjoyed cooking.
So do you remember the first thing that you made? Sometimes those are really funny dishes.
Yes. I remember I watched Food Network and it was Emeril. Emeril Lagasse was really big when I was little. And I made a stuffed shrimp with whatever we had at home. And my brother and I presented it to my parents and my dad loved it. And so then I was like, this was the first thing. I was like, I made something good, because I've made a lot of horrible things after that. But that was my first thing that I remember making that was like completely different from what we've eaten at home that my parents loved.
And Vietnamese food is very important to the food that you cook today. Mm-hmm. Did you grow up with a mom who cooked, and did you mm-hmm. make Vietnamese food with her, mm-hmm. under her supervision?
Actually, my mom worked a lot, so my grandmother took care of us as, you know, after school and stuff like that. And so she cooked a lot, so we always had a Vietnamese meal. Like, I didn't know American food until I started really going to school. We ate a Vietnamese meal every day, and on Saturdays, my grandmother would take me to the farmer's market, and this is, like, before farmers markets were cool. It's like super unregulated. Like, there's just ice on the ground and fish on top of it. And we would go shopping for whatever dish we were going to make that day. And it was like the dish that we'd make for the weekend. So then the whole family, the extended family, will come on Sunday. And we could make like steam buns or steamed rice crepes. And she would always say that I made it, even though I was like four.
And that's a nice way to give you some credit.
Yeah. And so I think that positive reinforcement went a long way.
So yeah, you have a couple of positive reinforcement there, right? Between your dad being like, this is awesome. Mm-hmm. And your grandma, she cooked it. Yeah. Like, I'm going to be a professional chef.
Yeah.
But the work that you ended up doing as a professional chef, that's really hard work. Like, did mm-hmm. you have professional training, or you went to Sucre and then that you got trained there?
So I was inspired by Sucre. I finished my degree, and that was more for a nod for my family. Like, I'm gonna finish school like you want me to, like typical Asian family. and then I enrolled in culinary school in New Orleans, but I didn't finish. I learned so much on the job, because you had to work and go to school, that I kind of felt like I didn't necessarily need the culinary school, because I wanted to learn such specific things. And so I trained a little bit, but I think I was just wise about the chefs I wanted to work for.
And so do you recommend culinary school as a general proposition, or would you say just go work for some great chef? Like,
yeah. I know, it's like so bad, but I think that if you really want to cook, go work for, like, if there's a chef that inspires you, show up and say, I'll work for free. I'll just work for a day. Let me cut these onions. And see if you really like it first, because culinary school can get really expensive. And if you don't love it, you're going to be in debt, and you don't really make that much money when you go out. So it's a big commitment.
It's a huge commitment.
Yeah.
But you also were teaching at a culinary school here, Cookspace, mm-hmm. which is a really very different thing. So on the one hand, you're like, oh, don't, you know, professional culinary school, maybe not. But for home cooks, you probably have a different point of view.
Yeah. I think a lot of people are very interested in learning how to cook, especially with all of the like blue aprons in the world. And so,
do you think that actually makes people want to cook more, or do you think that it's a shortcut and they'll get bored and then they'll stop cooking and just order in?
I think that they want to cook, but they might not know how. So then having something that is step by step is easy and more approachable.
What do you find most people did want to cook at Cookspace? Because you were teaching some Vietnamese classes.
Mm-hmm.
But was there anything you were surprised by? Like, I can't believe that people want to make steamed buns. Like, who wants to make that dough? Like, was there anything along those lines where you were really surprised?
Both, on both spectrums. A lot of the, like, ethnic cuisines sells a lot. But then also knife skills. You would be so surprised because, you know, as a chef, you don't really think about that. But a lot of people, it's the game changer class, you know, when you think, you know, you don't really need a peeler if you have a paring knife. And so I never knew how much people love that class. And some people will take it twice just in case if they might learn something. But at Cookspace, we do what we call the Culinary Confidence Series, where it's like 5 to 10 classes, and you show up once a week with the same group of people, and you learn fundamental skills. I really don't teach recipes. I think that everyone has their own taste buds, and they can determine whether they want it to be spicier, sour, you know, sweeter. And so I want to teach people how to cook for themselves first, and then
I don't know. Some people have zero confidence in their taste buds, so that could be very intimidating. I will say that before I was the editor-in-chief of Food and Wine, I was there as the executive editor. And as executive editor, I went to Peter Kump's cooking school, which is now ICE. And I took a knife skills class. And that is the only class that I've ever taken. And I didn't cook before Food and Wine. And, you know, during Food and Wine, I didn't have a lot of time to cook. And then I wrote this book about all the horrible mistakes I made. But that one class with the knife skills, I was sort of like undercover. I would go in, people say, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, you know, just, I work at a food magazine. But it was really great because I did learn how to use a knife. And I like a really big knife. I hate paring knives. And I like anything that's just big. I feel I have a lot more control with a big knife than I do with a small knife. I don't know why. Is there a reason that would be logical?
I like to think that I like bigger knives as well. I don't know, but whenever I teach people how to cut things, I'm like, just don't use that little inch that you always use. Like, use your whole knife. You paid for this much. Use it. And so that's what I'm like, you have more surface area. You don't have to wiggle so much.
I like that. So so then from you were working at Sucre, and then you came to New York, and you were cooking in New York, mm-hmm. right, with an extraordinary chef, because you're working with Angela Pinkerton.
Yes.
How did you end up in that kitchen?
When I moved here, I was a pastry chef, and apparently there was a shortage, because everywhere I staged, they were like, we would love to have you. And
are you sure it wasn't because you were brilliant?
I don't know.
Maybe you're brilliant.
but it was an amazing experience to stage at the places that I did.
So where did you stage?
I staged at Danielle, La Bernardin, 11 Madison Park. I really liked even Gotham Bar and Grill. And I was, of course, coming from the outside world, going into New York, you're looking at all of these Michelin-starred restaurants, and you're just like, do I have what it takes to hang with all of these chefs? And apparently they thought so.
Did that affect you in any way? Like, did it make you work harder, or like, you know, come in earlier or go home and practice more? Like,
yeah,
that thought in your head, like, am I good enough? Am I good enough? Like, how did you shut that up?
I just had to, I don't know. I was working so much that it's just, I'm like, I have to make this and I can prove to them that I can do all of this.
Was there anything else in your life before that that you worked as hard at as you ended up working in the kitchen?
I wish I could say yes, but that was a tough kitchen to adapt. It was just a different culture coming from New Orleans where everyone's like so laid back and we're like, oh, we love to party down here, to going to New York and it's like rigid. It's like, this is how we do it professionally. So I would say that adjustment about 6 months was probably the hardest time. I was homesick and it was a tough kitchen, but it made me so much better and stronger. Yeah.
And what do you feel like you learned there?
I like to say, like, they taught me techniques, but I knew a lot of those techniques before coming in. I think that working at EMP,
it's 11 Madison Park, yeah, under Angela.
Yeah. It really taught me how to be a good chef, to be outspoken, to speak up and be accountable for the things that happened. And that's just, like, that was a life changer. I think that...
Do you think being outspoken, because that's a different word than being articulate.
Yeah.
I mean, being outspoken means you want to, you know, be heard above the rest and differentiate yourself. Like, was that the key to it?
I think so. I think speaking up and, like, being able to, they really cultivate a culture where you should speak up. If you think something could be better, say it, because it doesn't hurt. It'll only make us better. And it's hard when a lot of times you work in competitive kitchens or just kitchens where there's definitely one chef and they don't want to hear anything and they're not open to feedback. But that was not the culture there. It was an amazing experience. If any chefs want to work, I think, like, you should work with kitchens like that.
And did you find it hard to find your voice? You know, did you know what you... Did you know what you wanted to say, so it was easy to say it, or, like, how did that work out?
It was hard in the beginning because I'm so shy. I'm like, what if I say something wrong? They don't make it that way. I think that it's almost like it's worse if you don't say one thing that could be improved. You know, a lot of the manager meetings, you have to bring in something that you think that should be improved, or it's like you're not even looking. And so that's just the culture that they cultivate. And that has really stuck with me. And I think that me being, I always blame it on being a Capricorn, but I am very, like, I'm going to tell you the truth. Stubborn, truthful, and, but only when I care about you. And so I feel like I embrace that. It's crazy, but it's really cool.
This idea of speaking the truth. That's the Capricorn part. I'm married to a Capricorn. Yeah. So I love Capricorns because they're extremely steady. It's really hard to destabilize them. Not that I try to destabilize my husband. I love him. But I love his you know, steadiness and the stubbornness, maybe a bit less so. Are you stubborn?
I am. I would like to think that I'm not, but I am. I know I am.
And where does that come from? Aside from Capricorn, of course.
I know. I think that I pick my battles. I'm usually very flexible, but if there's something that I'm like, I like it this way and I want it this way, I'm gonna say it. And if it's something that I have the power over, then that's gonna be the way it is.
And so you found your way to Top Chef, but that moment was a very challenging moment because you were you auditioned for the show at the same time that you found out that your brother, he was older than you.
He was younger.
He was younger than you.
Yeah.
Your brother, who's younger than you, had terminal cancer.
Yeah.
So when we come back, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to hear about this incredibly hard choice and the her amazing brother. So stay with us to hear more about Top Chef, all of you Top Chef fans. And we'll be right back.
This episode is presented by The Brooklyn Kitchen, a recreational cooking school on a mission to change the world by teaching people how to cook like grown-ups. The Brooklyn Kitchen began in 2006 when two creative home chefs, Taylor Erkinen and Harry Rosenblum, recognized an opportunity to create a community space with approachable, hands-on cooking classes and inventive culinary experiences. Taylor and Harry believe that cooking is a daily practice in creative problem solving. They bring this ethos to the Brooklyn Kitchen, a cooking school that fosters community and redefines home cooking for everyone. Now located at Sunset Park's Industry City, the Brooklyn Kitchen hosts a range of public and private cooking classes, corporate team parties, pop-up dinners, and tasting events for cooks of all levels. Learn more at thebrooklynkitchen.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Jenna Liut, and I'm the host of Eating Matters here on HRN. Join me as I talk to food systems experts about the issues that shape our experiences of buying, cooking, and eating food. You can find Eating Matters wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org. Welcome back. This is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly. My guest this episode is Nini Nguyen, and we're talking about like a tough subject, but one that I imagine you've come to terms with over time. So tell me about when Top Chef first came calling.
So I had applied many years before, and...
How does one apply?
Someone threw my name in the bag and a producer talked to me, and you have to like have a video, pictures, food, and you have to like Skype interview. So it's a process. And that year was a no, and then they called me again and they were very interested. And at that time, it was probably like February, and I was just in the middle, like in January, I found out that my brother was terminally ill, and I kind of just dropped everything I was doing here in New York to go home to help my family and him, because he's like my best friend. We're about a year and a half apart, so, and we both cook, and so it was just so...
And he was a chef.
Mm-hmm.
Where was he cooking?
He was cooking at Born in New Orleans for... It was part of the Besh group, but I know, whole nother thing.
Yeah, we'll leave that aside for this conversation.
Yeah.
And how did he find out that he had cancer?
He was having back pains, and he's 27 years old, so you wouldn't think, you know, it would be cancer. You're like, oh, you just have like muscle spasms, you're working out.
Or for a chef, I mean, you're lifting too many heavy pots, like just don't do that.
Exactly. And then just so happened, a student who was working with the doctor at the time was like, let's take an x-ray just to see. And then that's when they found lesions on his spine, and then they did like the full MRI CAT scan, and it was in 7 different places. Yeah.
And he hadn't felt any of it except the back.
Yeah. And it started in the stomach, and you wouldn't think anything because like he didn't have any like weight fluctuation or anything like that. So it was no symptoms, no signs. And then at that point, like it was like 2 months before it took him.
And they told you, I mean, they said, look, it's throughout his body. This is going to be fast.
Yeah. Like it was hard for us because we were like, he's young, we're going to fight. You know, you can't lose hope until you have to face reality. And so, they laid things out on the table and we're just like, we're going to try to fight it. It's like, it's worth a shot. And then when the time came, it's like, okay, like we're going to have to make peace with this. Top Chef called.
And you said no.
And I said no. I was not going to, I could never have that time back. So I said no, I hope, you know, maybe sometime in the future, but I can't do it right now.
And did you feel in any way that stomach cancer was just so unfair? Because, you know, he fed people and he fed their stomachs and then it was stomach cancer that took him down?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's hard because, you know, cancer is an awful thing and it is unfair to everyone, like the family, the friends. I definitely felt like I was like being robbed. But I'm thankful like you're thankful for the time you spend and the time that you have. Sorry. But I should have brought tissues.
No, I'm tissueless.
But oh, it's fine. Thank you. And so you have to be thankful for what you have. And I'm so thankful that I had my brother and we shared a passion. And if it wasn't like he wanted me to leave so bad, he was like, you have to go. This is your chance. And I said, I'm not. There's no way I'm going. And so I promised him, I was like, if they ever call again and I'm mentally okay, I will do it. And so they called again the next year and I said no, because I was just not ready. And it had only been a year and there was, you know, therapy, everything. I couldn't do it. I knew I couldn't. And then last year they called again and I was working at Cookspace, building like this culinary school I was really excited about. And I think I finally kind of overcome that like horrible thing that happened to me. And
I mean, not that one ever really overcomes that. But did you feel in any way like it's great to be there cooking and he really wanted you to, but you just wished he could see that?
Yeah. There were moments on Top Chef. Actually, the first win, I should have been happy. I was like, oh my God, I just won. I literally thought I was going to be eliminated on the second episode. And then they're like, NeNe, you won. And I was like, what? But then I was so happy. But there was always like a piece of sadness in me, and I remember weeping in the bathroom where the cameras weren't there. And then I won again. I won the third episode, and then I just lost it. I cried. We had the women hung out on one side of the house, like our rooms, and then the men on the other side. So we called it the women's wing, where they had vanities, which was so perfect for us. And so I was in the vanity room and I just started crying, and then all of us kind of hugged and kind of talked about the people we've lost in our life, and it was so nice to like kind of let that go and like be okay with that, and know that all the other contestants have, you know, everyone has their things. And
I just think a brother so close in age and so aligned with what your passion is. I mean, did you cook together as kids? Was he with your grandma too, and going to the market? So it's not just you; it was the two of you.
Yeah, we definitely cooked a lot. We loved watching Iron Chef, and so then I'm like, let's play Iron Chef, but he would hate it because he would always be the sous chef, and he's like, I don't want to clean.
is that your bossy Capricorn thing, or the older sister, or all?
I think it was like me being bossy, or me being like, well, if you do this and I'll do this. And I would always have like the better deal, better end of the deal. But we cooked a lot, and we were very like, we would experiment, and it was so much fun. Food was always a thing. We go grocery shopping with our mom every week, and it was just something that we just did as a family. And so, yeah, it was hard because I was so close to him, and we shared so many things in common, and
it's really like losing a piece of yourself. I mean, losing a piece of your family is one, of course, horrible. But I'm wondering what role food played when he was ill. You know, was he able to eat, or was he all tube bound?
Yeah, he did eat. Like, I remember one time he took a medicine and he lost his taste buds for a second, and he freaked out. But then it came back. and my way of like through this stressful time was to cook. And so I would cook for him, and he loved this rice porridge dish that we usually make when people are sick. And it's with chicken and ginger. It's like Chinese congee, but I think it's better. But and so I would make that like once a week for him, and he would love fried chicken. And at that point, I was like, I'm going to just get you all of the things you love to eat in the city. So I would just go and get like gnocchi or pizza or Reuben's, like everything. Anything he wanted, I got.
Wow. So, and where did you get them? I'm sure you were very particular about where you got them from, right? Yeah. Like, where's the perfect gnocchi? Where's the perfect pizza? Where's the perfect fried chicken? I'd love to know that, like, that New Orleans list.
So, gnocchi, we would always get it from Ancora. Pizza, if you like New York style, pizza delicious. But then Ancora also has, like, great Neapolitan style. Reuben's or any sandwiches that are, like, Jewish-centric, I guess. Stein's Deli. It's probably my favorite, even out of New York. People are gonna like kill me over here. but it's so delicious. And I'm like, what else? Oh, fried chicken. Strangely enough, Popeyes.
There are a lot of people who love Popeyes.
Yeah.
Huh.
It's a good thing.
Is that your fried chicken anywhere? Favorite fried chicken anywhere?
Yeah, I think so. It depends, I guess. Like, unless I'm in. Yeah, no, I love Popeyes, but I think Popeyes in Louisiana tastes different. I think it's spicier.
That could be true.
Yeah, who knows?
And were you feeding your parents as well?
Yeah, my parents, they would still try to work at least, but then we would always grab something to go or something, and we would have dinner in the room with him. Yeah.
And so in competing for Top Chef and knowing you were sort of doing it for him, you got eliminated. Mm-hmm. You made a good stab at it, though.
Yeah.
And you did win. You know, you won a couple of you won a couple of times. Did that create any emotion around your brother? You know, because you were doing this for him and you wanted to win for him.
Yeah, I think for one, like getting on was already like a big accomplishment because I was like, what if they don't want? I even told the casting producer, I was like, this is the last time. I'm not doing it again. It's now or never. And I think that's when they were like, oh, she's kind of crazy, so let's cast her. And I, winning felt amazing. And it was like one more for my brother. And then when I got eliminated, it was tough, but then I was still proud. Like, I think that, you know, at least when I was on fire. And even though I left, sooner and didn't win, I think that my brother would have been proud of me.
I think he would have been right thrilled you did it. He told you to do it, and
yeah,
he did.
I did. It was crazy.
I'm sure there's obstacles. I mean, you know, you can get a casting call. That's not the same as being cast.
Yeah.
And so that is pretty great. And your parents originally had been somewhat reluctant to see you go from, you know, business school or mm-hmm. business direction into cooking, as you're saying that Asian background.
Exactly.
But they have also, they've come around.
Yes. My parents are so supportive. My dad is kind of a dreamer type, and so he was always secretly supportive. As soon as I said I wanted to be a chef, he bought me a KitchenAid, he bought me knives, like he bought me all of like
that's my... That's not so secret.
Exactly. And my mom's like, you know, it's not too late. You could always go to medical school. And I'm like, Mom, you did not see my grades in college. And so I... My dad was really supportive. My mom, she knows who I am, and she's like, you're going to do what you want to do. And so when I told her I was going to New York, she's like, you're crazy. She's like, it's so dangerous there. And I'm like, no, we are in New Orleans where the crime is very high. And so I'm like, I will be safer there, I promise. And she cried, of course, and she said, okay. And still.
Well, it also must have been hard with... And now that your brother's gone mm-hmm. and for you to be in New York.
Yeah. She's like, are you ready to have kids? I'm ready to be a grandma and you can bring them, you can move home and have kids. So I'll watch them. And I'm like, I'll think about it. I mean, it's every day it gets more attractive to like move back home, but we'll see.
Wait, that's so interesting. Does it actually get more attractive to move back home?
Yeah. The cost of living in New Orleans is a lot lower. People love food, and in an ideal world, I would love to have something kind of like CookSpace in New Orleans or do something with ceramics. I also make ceramics.
I want to hear about that. You have, it's called the Baker's Clay?
Yes.
And what type of ceramics do you make?
I like to make, like tableware, and sometimes like little or like ornament type things, but I love tableware and I have like deep fascination for sea creatures. So sometimes you'll see sea creature themed things on my table.
Does that mean that you don't like to cook fish because you love them so much?
No, I love seafood. you can't be from the Gulf and not love seafood. But I think they're also beautiful.
And so we said at the beginning that this is your year of yes. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about that because the year of yes can bring all kinds of things into the net. Why did you decide it's your year of yes?
So I did Top Chef and it's aired. And now Cookspace is in such a great place where I don't have to be there all the time. I teach a class maybe once a month now. And so I've opened myself up to be able to explore and see what opportunities there is for me. And the only way is if I say yes. I'm usually a no person.
And what do you say no to? Like, if you're a no person generally.
Yeah, everyone's like, you should do this, you should do that. Or like, let's do this. And I'm like, I like to be realistic. I really love my time and who I spend my time with. And it's very sacred to me. And so then if I feel like something isn't worth my time, I'm going to say no. And so then it's usually no for most things. But now I've changed my like train of thought and I'm like, this is my yes year and everything's going to be worth my time. Something has value in like, so I'm just going to do whatever.
I think it's great to prize your time. I really, it's a very hard lesson to learn and to assess, like, do I care enough to give this my time? But you sound like a very tough critic if most things don't pass the I want to spend my time on this test. Is that because you like actually being alone?
I think, one, I like to keep myself busy. If there was anything, if I had any downtime, I want to use it on ceramics. And so it's like if I do this and it takes away from something that I love to do with my free time that I find very rewarding. So that's usually the scale. And so in the many years before, I was like, nope, ceramics reign supreme. But now I've taken a break from ceramics to do like all of this and I was working so much. And so now it's my yes year, so everybody take advantage of it.
Because she's going to say yes. All you listeners, let's see. That could bring you some very, very, to very interesting places, I think.
Yeah.
I do think that the year of yes is often followed by a year of no, because then you realize you said yes to all these things, and some of them turn out to be valuable. But you don't know before you say yes.
Yeah.
So
you better go before the stores close.
The sale is on. And what are you most looking forward to? Like, do you have plans throughout this year of yes?
I am traveling. I'm going to Asia. I'm taking my boyfriend to Vietnam. And I've been only once before, but I spent like a month, about 5 weeks there. And so I'm excited to show him that. But the summer, it's pretty open. But it's strange because things will book up in spurts. And so,
and I've had that experience myself. Like I struggle with open time because I like being busy, but I also want that white space. So it's a constant struggle for me. But I know that, often just 1 month out, I'm like, oh my gosh, May is going to be so amazing because I have so much white space, so much time to think and, you know, work on these projects of my own. And then 2 weeks ahead, it's like, how did the entire month fill up? So the idea that you don't have anything quite planned for the summer, that's today.
Yeah.
And like in 2 weeks, I'm sure we'd be having a very, a very different conversation. Is there anything about the way in which, your brother's passing and Katrina and sort of the impermanence has affected you for the year of yes?
I think that like Katrina was hard and I think I was young and I didn't, a lot of people were like, that's such a devastating thing. And I was like, actually, yes, it was. But then it's like, you have to deal with it. There's nothing to change. And it pivoted my life to a whole nother way, like world. And so I'm kind of thankful for Katrina to happen. And then with my brother, it just taught me a lesson to cherish things a little bit more, to do all of the things. Like, everything I do now is for him, or like for both of us, you know, because he couldn't do it. I'm going to Japan, and that's a place that he's always wanted to go. And so when I'm on that side of the world with Vietnam, I'm going to go to Japan as well. And so it's like everything I do is for us because he couldn't do it. And I guess, yeah, that's how it changed me.
Do you feel like he's still with you somewhere?
Yeah, definitely. I think anytime I'm scared or I'm nervous, I'm just like, he's not going to let me do, like, nothing bad's going to happen to me. And then, I mean, it might be irrational to think that, but then it's comforting as well. And so I'm like, it will calm me down. And then I go and do my day.
So, on the show, each time we always pay it forward to an extraordinary woman who in the hospitality industry who hasn't gotten enough attention. And I'm wondering if there's someone in the world who, as you've navigated this universe, who you feel needs more attention, a light shined on them.
Yeah, I'm going to say my old mentor, Angela Pinkerton. I think she is an incredible woman, and she's taught me to be strong. Like, I always feel like I was kind of strong, but she taught me to be stronger. And
how did she do that?
I just by example, just.
And what way? In what way is she strong?
She's also outspoken. And if she saw, like, I would say if something was. I'm like, how do I word this? She's very firm. She can tell you what she wants, but in a way that you're not afraid of her. You know, you respect her and you're like, I want to do this because I don't want to let you down. And she led a team that was just, I loved it. I really admire her, and I feel like she's really created me to be the chef that I've always wanted to be. And
what did she pull out in you that you weren't even sure was there?
I think because it's so hard to be in the intense world to be compassionate. If, you know, understand that other people have anxieties and it's still just food, and be kind to everyone. Yeah.
And where is she now?
She is at, I can't remember, FICO, Chef FICO.
Oh, right, K FICO.
Yeah.
In San Francisco's fantastic restaurant that mm-hmm. she co-founded. Mm-hmm. And it's been a huge success.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Nini, for joining us today on Speaking Broadly. If people want to follow your adventures, where do they find you?
On social media?
Yes.
I'm like, what? It's I Dream of Nini. I Dream of period Nini on Instagram.
And actually, I realized we didn't talk about your dinner lab time at all.
Oh, yeah.
I bring it up because our great friend Andrea Pinkard introduced us, and that's actually how I know you. And that we skipped over an entire part of your life. Yeah. Was there any one lesson before I tell you where to find me on Instagram?
From dinner lab. That things might be overwhelming, but you can definitely make it happen. Just make it happen.
Yeah, you have a tremendous, that Capricorn determination is coming through in every single job that you've had. And thank you all for listening. I'm so happy that you got to hear Nini's story today. If you like what you hear, please subscribe on iTunes or anywhere else where podcasts are found. And you can DM me. You can follow me at Speaking Broadly. I love having you listen and just love hearing what you think. Have a really great week, and I'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.